CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 58, with Dr. Lisa Arbisser, excellence in cataract surgery.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, Dr. Lisa Brothers Arbisser, a fantastic ophthalmologist who's been such an educator for decades. I even recall back more than 20 years ago being at an academy or ASRS meeting in a wet lab and having Dr. Lisa say, "No, let me teach you how to do that," and literally holding my hands. So fondness in my heart for you, and I'm so appreciative of all the teaching you've done. Welcome to our podcast.
It's really a privilege to be here. You know, you have become an icon in making teaching accessible to our entire profession, and it's really quite something. So I count it very special that you remember anything that I helped with.
Oh, you're so instrumental. In fact, that's one of the things that kind of propels me, is to pass on like how you taught me to teach the next generation. And so I think, yeah, now in the digital era, we can just get our message across worldwide instantly.
It was quite amazing. And, you know, it used to be for me, I used to maybe do some coaching individually. You know, I sometimes do. I'll go into the OR with somebody, you know, just to observe and, you know, make notes in my mind. And then we can go over videos later. And, you know, it's one-on-one. Whereas, you know, you know, anybody who has an issue, a problem, a question, you know, you can go online and find some very legitimate and wonderful, helpful answers from you. So it's quite something you've achieved.
Oh, thank you. You know, we're still learning so much. I remember last year, I was very honored to give the Wolf Foundation lecture at University of Iowa, and I showed a case of a phaco wound burn. And then afterwards, you had some extra pearls for me about how to handle that, things that I didn't even realize. So even now, 25 years into my career, I'm still learning every day.
That's really the beauty of ophthalmology, isn't it? And the fact that we need to do that. You know, I actually gave that Wolf lecture a few years before you. Yes. and the thing is that I think that the key to enjoying, not only enjoying your professional life, but also serving patients, is to be constantly aware of being an early adopter. You know, for me, there was a very fine line between, I've never been on the leading edge. I sort of consider that the bleeding edge, you know, so it's having the wisdom, you know, to know when not to miss the bandwagon nor eat its dust, you know, not to jump on it or eat its dust, because, you know, different things require different understanding of that, of what it might mean. Like when topical anesthesia was described, I did it the next week. You know, if it can be done, I can do it. You know, when a clear corneal incision was described, I waited 6 to 8 months to do that. I waited a long time for foldable lenses, because until clear corneal incision, it didn't matter that much. It was a couple millimeters difference in your scleral tunnel, you know, and so I missed a lot of problems with that. Anyhow, those are the kinds of things that we gain with age and judgment and knowledge and wide reading of the literature, as well as meetings and learning new things.
How do you find that balance of like you said, you could be an early adopter at the leading edge, which may be the bleeding edge, or you could be a real, real late adopter where you're in everyone's dust. How do you figure out that balance of when to get in?
Well, I think part of it is the problems that you're presented with by patients, you know, so I one of the wonderful things that happened to me was going to the University of Iowa for my training, which at that time was a 3.5-year residency, kind of a mini fellowship, and really being trained in a way that I could go out into practice. And my husband and I started a practice, and I did open globes, I did buckles, I did PKPs and trabeculectomies and plastics even, you know, and really I learned phaco pretty much on my own and didn't go full time into it until the capsulorhexis was described. So part of it is a background of a holistic knowledge of how to assess various, you know, I think it's kind of a shame that we concentrate on anterior segment versus posterior segment. And in fact, I'm one of the advocates of maybe having a middle segment subspecialty, which I think, you know, is becoming more and more germane to patient care. And living in Iowa, that, you know, was a big decision for me growing up in Manhattan, you know, after training in Iowa to decide to practice, live there and practice and raise a family. And my husband had grown up in the Midwest, but not there. But, you know, know, my dad said, you know, the only, he was a physician on Park Avenue, and, you know, the only live culture is going to be in the yogurt, you know, it wasn't the least bit true. And it was just a joke on his part anyway, you know, but we went where we were needed. That was really the point, where, you know, and so what I could do is I could learn things. I could read about it. I could learn it. If it was evident it was required and not easy to find by my patients, then I would go and shadow somebody who did that a bunch. And then I would say to patients, you know, I have the knowledge and I believe the skills to bring to the table to fix your problem, but there is somebody who does that all the time. And I'll be happy to send you to that person for this problem. And I'll still take care of you when you come home and be in touch. And, you know, you'll still be my patient, or I will take care of it for you if you would like to trust me to do my very best. And that was an ethical way of doing new things. You know, I was in the IDE for CTRs and really never part of my not being on the leading edge was that it was a private practice, and we really didn't have a coordinator, research coordinator, you know, and all of that. And there were certain things I was willing to do and others I wasn't. Like, you know, when I know placebo isn't as good as treatment, am I going to compare something new to placebo? Well, for me, no. It's a matter of thinking through, of having a holistic knowledge and then thinking through and looking at people's results and reading the literature and deciding what takes time to prove itself as safe.
Right.
And then jumping on as soon as you feel it's there and it's needed.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance. But yeah, you brought a lot of firsts to your area. You said about the CTR, the caps retention rings, but you brought many other firsts to the area.
Actually, when we first moved to Iowa, I was the first to do outpatient cataract surgery. The first, you know, all sorts of things. First to do sutureless and all kinds of things. Actually, using off-label devices. With I even went to our local university to the ethics department. And ended up being on the citizens advisory board of that, but to ask how do I properly inform patients of something that's new and not yet FDA approved, but I think has significant benefits. And, you know, they advised me about how to explain that to people. And we even videoed a lot of that, you know, just so we would have that sort of thing and then let people make a fair and informed decision for themselves to some extent. Many patients can't do that, but many can and deserve to.
Well, and by being such a great patient advocate, you grew this tiny one room practice to four locations in two states with 24 doctors and 200 employees. Tell me about this whole process. That sounds amazing.
Well, to start with, I have to give my husband credit. My husband is a pediatric ophthalmologist. We've been married for 48 years now. We met at Princeton. I was the second class of women to matriculate there. My 50th anniversary is this May. And he was a senior. I was a freshman. And we met, and our parents met and loved it. It's almost an arranged marriage in a way. It took us 6 years to decide to marry. And he just has a great business mind. And he also has an amazingly appropriately adjusted ego. So as soon as he felt that I was doing a better job of cataract surgery than he was, he quit doing it like that. Or as soon as he felt that the practice needed, that our area could not support two pediatric ophthalmologists, and other practices were talking about competing with us in that way, he recruited a great person by just giving him all his surgery. Wow. Right off the bat. I think the other thing is we're a little socialist about it. it was really his concept to divide up. First of all, it took us 10 years to get a real partner because we were mom and pop, you know, and people, one person wouldn't feel they'd be fair necessarily, you know, coming treated fairly or whatever. And so it did take us time. But I think the main thing in building this practice was just doing a great job and caring about patients and caring about caring about our employees like family. And we also have four children. So we also cared about our home care people just like family, paid them the same way we paid our office people who were far more educated. But, you know, that way we had the same people for 30 years at home, you know, with our kids. It also, he pushed me a lot to do certain things. For example, I enjoyed seeing patients for their routine 1-year visits and all that, you know, for a period of time. But then I was really great at surgery, and I couldn't do more. So he had me transition from that to only seeing surgical patients, from that to, I developed a course when I was president of the ACES, American College of Eye Surgeons, on the perioperative care of the cataract patient with an optometrist of ours, in order to be able to co-manage within our practice. So anyone who saw a post-op of mine had the same information, the same, you know, what is a LOX 3, you know, what is a 3 plus cell, you know, that sort of thing. So always cognizant of best patient care, we added subspecialists. And then, of course, I stopped doing, you know, retina stuff. And if we divided our money in a certain way that was very fair, I could be 4 days a week and one of my kids were little, and nobody would be upset, because part of the compensation was how many days you work, not just production. And we also wrote off the bottom line of the practice, Medicaid and, you know, insurance things, so people wouldn't cherry pick their patients for payment. So there were a lot of things that led to that. I think when we started, part of it might be that we were fairly renowned because my mother was world famous as a psychologist. I don't know if you know Dr. Joyce Brother. She was considered the mother of media psychology. And so everywhere I went all my life, you know, I was sort of, you know, look who's coming, you know, look who's here. But then we rapidly changed it from being about her to being about us, to a great extent through philanthropy, as well as just doing a great job and being someone that people could trust for a good outcome.
But I should also mention some unusual philanthropy, like bringing a circus to town. You have to tell our audience this. This is amazing.
We did not bring it to town. Every year, Barnum and Bailey, by the way, when I was a child, I even got to ride one of the elephants in the parade, and I always loved the circus, you know, and nobody really knew, but it was my 50th birthday present from Amir, but really it was to celebrate 20 years of surgery, of doing surgery in the Quad Cities, and my husband Amir, totally on his own, had the brilliant idea, you know, to let's do something for the patient, something really special. And, you know, the greatest show on earth, you know, when I make you see, you want to see color, you want to see movement, you want to see fabulous stuff. So he actually was the only individual in the history of Barnum and Bailey to buy an 8,700 seat one performance of the circus in our area. And they made me honorary ringmaster. We sent 2 tickets to every patient I had ever operated on so they could invite somebody. And we had all the public school teachers come, and our employees' families. And, you know, we gave everybody a free popcorn. It was a year of planning. I mean, 30,000 pieces of mail. The sky boxes were donated by the community so people in wheelchairs could come. And we had medics, and we had tents, and we had buses. It was wild. And it was amazing. I mean, we got letters for years after that. You know, I would never have been with my father on the day that he, you know, he died the next day. And I'm sure he lived just to be at the circus. And I was with him. And thank you. I remember 90-year-olds that remembered holding their dad's hands to watch the elephants put up the tent, but they could never afford to go to the performance. And just amazing things, agoraphobes who fell after this, they could go out again, you know, and just it was an incredible impact that was just so heartwarming and beautiful for all involved. And it was really my husband's brainchild.
Wow, what an incredible idea for your secret 50th birthday. I love it. That's fantastic. And obviously, patients are so, so appreciative.
You know, we have thousands of letters. Actually, we have a friend of one of my children that does some very creative things, and he may do something. We saved the letters. We just couldn't throw them out. I mean, there were just 1,000 letters or more, you know, thousands of letters that, you know, were so amazing stories and heartwarming things. And maybe we'll make something out of that somehow. I don't know if that'll happen. But anyhow, that was extraordinary. But we did many little things too. And, you know, anything we gave to, we put the practice's name on as well as ours. And the only thing we ever advertised, we didn't spend money on advertising. You know, it was word of mouth. The only thing we had to advertise was LASIK early on. If you didn't advertise the LASIK, the phones were quiet. And, you know, I had a partner that did that. I never did LASIK, or I chose not to do RK. And by the time LASIK came around, I already had a cornea specialist partner.
Oh, fantastic. Now, I think you have some very important ideas of how to grow that practice. And one of them was, and this is probably a big challenge for a lot of ophthalmology community, is you are super fair. Because oftentimes, it's the more established doctor hires the new one and kind of takes advantage of him or her, especially financially. It happened to me. That's why I left that situation and just did solo practice. But it happens to, I'd say the majority of my colleagues that I know or friends in ophthalmology, it's happened to them.
Well, we had 2 years of, you know, being an employee to be sure that we could get along. Right. And then the guarantee was to become a partner, a full partner at that point. And we did a lot to make that happen early on. It took us 10 years, as I said, to get somebody to join us. And there were two wonderful subspecialists coming out of the Army who are friends together, who joined us together. And they really couldn't afford, you know, to pay what the practice was on paper worth, you know. So we traded call for that, you know, and we paid for call, and we, you know, so that they were able to come in at a lesser price, and they were, you know, willing and able to, you know, to take the call, and we would be responsive to our own patients, but not all the hospitals, you know, and so on. They did that. And so there were many ways in which, part of it is our plan from the very beginning was to be in practice for 30 years. We thought that would be enough, and then we should have another life, you know, and that's pretty much what we stuck to. The last 4 years, you know, we job shared. Another unique thing that my husband's brainchild is, was my
brainchild as well. Tell us about that. That's with the Arnolds.
You know, Priscilla was president of ASCRS, and I knew her through ACEs and various things. And Paul was a resident with me at University of Iowa. And for personal reasons, they had changed their own situation and were together and later in life and were not that happy with their situation. And so my husband came up with this idea that, you know, we're near the end of our practice. We want to take up more time. We want to be with, you know, the kids, you know, and they're very places. And so he came up with the concept that they would just come for a month, plug into everything we have, use all of our overhead, our trained assistants, be in our ORs with our techs and everything, and we would leave. And then we would work for a month and they would leave. And we did that for 4 years. And, you know, we were a great team. And it's not like we had to leave so that, you know, if you had a complication or something, you could stay, but that never did happen, you know. And we were able as a team to do a great job, even pediatric trauma and so on, you know. We would explain to them, I would be the surgeon, you know, Priscilla would be there after, you know, she was there before, and we're a team. And we did some great patient care that way and used our overhead more than anybody else because we only had maybe a couple of days of overlapping, you know, meetings to go to. And otherwise, we were there full time using our overhead. And we took the risk. Our partners were not going to even consider. So we took all the financial risk for that, and it ended up wonderful, you know, and everybody was satisfied.
Yeah, such a novel idea. I've never even thought of that.
Well, and a month was all I felt I could really take off and sit down for my first case and feel comfortable, you know. And we had faith in their abilities, so, you know, nobody would be harmed. And if I'm the name and people want to wait an extra couple months for me, big deal, they'll wait. And if they want surgery now, you know, Paul and Priscilla had a great book of surgery right from the start.
That's so fantastic. And then you've transitioned the practice now to your other partners, and you're now fully retired.
Oh yeah, I'm fully retired from patient care. Almost fully retired from ophthalmology. I transitioned into the joy of more teaching, you know, really. But yeah, we didn't put our name on it. It's Eye Surgeons Associates. We specifically did not put our name on it because we wanted it to be all theirs when we were gone, and you know, not be responsible for what they do or vice versa, you know. And so that was part of the beauty of having people join as full partners, is that, you know, we were 2 of 12 partners by the end, and a good part of the reason that we were also comfortable to quit when we did, because they had other ways of looking at things, you know, than we did, and you know, their goals and so on were a little different than ours. So it worked out, you know, that everybody got control when they needed and deserved it.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful way of doing things. It makes so much sense. Now, you also have some side projects, like the Minute Clinic, the Minute Suites. You got to tell us about this.
Well, I had an idea years ago when I was traveling to meetings and everything, and you know, I was just so miserable in airports. You know, there was no place quiet from all the, you know, all the announcements and all of this. Wouldn't it be great, you know, if you had a little hotel room or a little thing, and we'd traveled the world, and you know, you have those things in other places, and there was no such thing in the U.S. So my husband took the idea, kind of my idea, but he ran with it and implemented it, and we're in I think 13 different airports right now, and it's a room to rent inside security. That's the key. Yeah. Is that you already know exactly how far you are from your gate. You know, there's no uncertainty of lines and this and that and TSA. And we have a surgery center cleaning protocol. So it's the safest, cleanest place you can be. And, you know, TV, a computer, a day bed, you can noise canceling and light and temperature control, and rent by the hour or overnight. And some have bathrooms and showers to rent, not all of them. So you can just lock your door and go out to the public restroom if you know need to, or leave your bags there. There's nowhere to. I think this really came to a head when you know, when they stopped having lockers for your bags because of, you know, bombers and things, and so you'd have to drag your stuff with you wherever, so you couldn't exercise, you know, in the airport or go nicely to eat, so you can leave your bags and so on. So that's been sort of he's CEO of that, and we have a number of mainly Quad Cities investors, our friends, and it's been a long haul, and we're hoping this is really going to maybe pay off at some point soon, but we'll see about that. It's a great idea. Once you've stayed there, you know, you don't want to be anywhere else if you have a layover.
I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So he's really an entrepreneur, you know, as well as a wonderful pediatric ophthalmologist, and never had any real interest in academia at all. He didn't. My projects revolve more around trying to improve cataract surgery and ophthalmology, you know, And those are things that I've not had a whole lot of traction in getting people to change to. But for years, I went to Vienna to train with Rupert Menapace to learn primary posterior capsulorhexis and optic capture, since he had done a marvelous prospective intra-patient inter-eye study on this that was, you know, to prove it non-inferior. And I did that for all my pediatric cases, anyone who couldn't sit for a YAG, and sometimes as a premium thing to do. And couldn't really get anybody to bite. To my way of thinking, if you're going to have an intact hyoid for life, never have secondary visual loss from posterior capsule, and you always prefer the eye with no capsule compared to that 20/20 perfect Snellen acuity capsule as a stray light, why wouldn't you add 2 minutes to your case, you know, with 150 learning curve and learn to do that? On the more forward thinking side, I'm interested in capturing, unfortunately we have so little technology on three-piece lenses, but in for years for really bad zonules, I was involved with that for a long time. As I said, I was on the IDE for the CTR, and you know, soon learned that CTR isn't good enough to keep people from having bad lens subluxation. Sure. For whatever reason, I'm only aware of one in all the maybe 30,000 cases I did, only four subluxations and one dead bag that I'm aware of to this date, but I don't have all my data the way I really should. But for a long time at the end, I would place a three-piece lens in the sulcus, optic capture anteriorly with a CTR in the bag, and right. they were way more stable. I did that very early on. They were very stable compared to a lens in the bag. So, but they all needed a YAG fairly early. Later, after I stopped seeing patients, it occurred to me, and I had done this in some trauma cases and so on, that why not capture from the sulcus through anterior and posterior capsules, kind of like the bag and the lens. Marie Jose has taught me so much and is so brilliant about the retrolenticular space that is still a huge fertile area for understanding and progress in ophthalmology. I'm still looking for somebody interested in doing a non-inferiority study on that, with the long-term hope, if we do it in pseudo-exfoliation patients, that we may have less bag lens subluxation. But of course, that we can't document for 8 to 12 years, you know. But you can see the stability and the lack of pseudophakodenesis and the lack of phimosis and all of that, you know. So tried to get ESCRS to do it this past year. I was encouraged to show them the study. We wrote it at Utah, where I'm an adjunct professor, but they couldn't find a principal investigator. Nobody's interested in like going there right now.
So interesting. So what I would do now, if I had a pseudo exfoliation patient and I'm operating and the bag is very loose, when you have your empty capsule bag, I would do what you said earlier. I'd put a CTR in the capsule bag. I'd put a three-piece lens, haptics in the sulcus, and then capture the optic behind my capsular axis. And I have found also that even on the table, if I have the IOL in the bag, there is a shaking or shimmering or moving. But once you do that optic capture with the haptics in the sulcus, it's totally stable.
And it blocks the phimosis of the anterior capsule because the optic is there. So you don't have to do early relaxing incisions. And the only trouble with that is you're going to YAG all those patients pretty much, you know, and that means you're blowing their hyoid. And often they're a little early, so you also don't have the stocking in, so you lose your two-chambered eye really, because you don't really have that barrier that you would have in a late YAG, you know. And so I feel strongly that keeping that hyoid intact for life is going to have benefits for glaucoma as well as retinal detachment. You know, Menapace only studied out to 6 months, you know, in a coordinated way. So he did a non-inferiority study, but it stands to reason. Also, when you opt to capture, you know, you don't have to worry about the size and, you know, centration of your lens, you know, when you, you know, changing in a big eye and, you know, so on and so forth. So I think there are a myriad potential advantages. So maybe try my hyoid sparing double capture when you have bad zonules and you know that patient will see without a YAG forever, right. and see what happens, you know, because there's no one has done that in any numbers so far, to my knowledge.
Take us through the steps. So you have a patient, you do, again, pseudoexfoliation patient, very loose zonule support. You get the cataract done. Now you have an empty capsule bag. Now what's your next step?
Your next step is you put your OVD, cohesive OVD, in the sulcus so that you make a single plane of your anterior and posterior capsules.
Okay.
Then you take a 30 gauge and you're sure that all your, you know, everything, there should be no posterior pressure. It's amazing how little there is. If you look at intraoperative OCT, which Marie-Jose has done, Tessillon in Belgium, you'll see that the anterior hyoid is just like so diaphanous, right? But when you start your Rexis, you could have a potential space of the hyoid right in contact with the posterior capsule, or it could be a real space, often a real space because fluid has gone behind zonules. And if you're, you know, like some people that jack their pressure up, and I think the best thing that's happened lately is physiologic pressures in machines, you know, in phaco machines. I digress. At any rate, because of that potential space, you need to take a 30 gauge. You want to go high gauge. You want to have a nice view. You know, I always put Viscote in the beginning of a case on my cornea, a few drops of BSS, and then no one ever has to irrigate that eye again. So the patient isn't flinching and you don't have to depend on your, you know, tech to know when to fix your vision or have that moment of not seeing, you know, when they're irrigating. And so you go on high mag, you've got your two capsules together. You take a 30 gauge syringe, a 30 gauge needle, and you make a wrinkle in that posterior capsule so that you then can lift a little circular tag off of that. Okay. Then you take your cohesive OVD and you put it down through that hole you just made, and that'll cause the hyoid to go backwards. Okay. And if Wiegert's ligament's intact, you'll see it fill completely into itself. But in old people, often Wiegert's isn't intact. So at least you do see it start to fill, but you won't be able to get a full Burger space, you know, fill. But you just need to know that your hyoid is enough away from your posterior capsule that starts to have a hole. Now, I would only do a primary posterior rexus if I know I have a decent anterior rexus, because that's my safety net, right? Because I can always capture forward, capture back, you know, anterior capture, whatever. And so you have that as a cookie cutter. And so now you just take the edge. You can use a regular, a lot of people like to use a small, Utrati, you know, the small one that goes through a paracentesis, but you have such beautiful control of the chamber virtually always. When you start this, you can just use a Utrata, and your forces need to be a little more centripetal. It's a little more like a pediatric cataract. It's more elastic. It's about 4 microns thick instead of 14, like we're used to with the anterior capsule. And so you just grasp and you re-grasp more often, because you always need to be pulling in a little, or else it expands like a pediatric cataract, you know, like a pediatric capsule does. And so you're pulling in just a little bit until you complete it. And now if you want a standard optic capture, now you put your OVD into the bag to separate your spare tire, right? You have your anterior rexus above, your posterior rexus below, your hyoid well controlled below that with OVD cushion. And now you put your three-piece lens. Don't use another half a millimeter or millimeter of incision is fine. You know, do not do tunnel assist, because it'll shoot in. You know, you want nice control, and you want to just lead that anterior, the anterior haptic, the leading haptic, straight into the bag, and then you can nicely rotate it into the bag. And any OVD left behind doesn't matter. It doesn't have access to the trabecular meshwork. It will not create a pressure rise. Menapace showed this conclusively in his studies. And so now if you have a lens in the bag, or you put a three-piece in the sulcus and bicapsulotomy captured, then you don't have to worry about what's behind the lens at all. But whatever's behind the lens, you keep. But now that you've done your posterior capture only, now you need to, it's nice to put a little Myocol E, or else at least hold the capsule back. You can't afford to lose chamber anymore, because you might uncapture, just like if you had a vitreous loss. You know, you need to be careful that you remove the OVD from anterior to the lens, and don't allow an uncapture. And you have a beautiful routine case in children, unfortunately, we don't have a 90 degree optic haptic junction lens. Mm-hmm. And also it's a pity that we don't have toricity on it, because anytime you capture, you're never going to rotate, right?
Right.
But LAL, I'm thinking, might be good for this kind of thing, because it is three-piece, though it's not at all a 90-degree optic-haptic junction, because the only place that cells can sneak is at the optic-haptic junction.
Right.
And so if that's very broad, like in a one-piece lens, it's not ideal, although Jason Jones has captured a lot of those, but I think it allows the potential for vitreous prolapse around, or cells to grow under. And in children, the cells are so aggressive, they can grow on the anterior hyoid. But still, it's rare that they do, or it takes it 5 years and one little touch with the ag once they're old enough to sit, you know. So I did that in all my pediatric cases, and as I said, in people who don't sit for ag. So that's how it is. It adds 2 minutes to the case. Right. Menapace says it's 150 learning curve. I had one complication in my first 100, which was a pediatric intumescent cataract that probably had dysgenesis. Marie-Jose has shown us there's dysgenesis of Burger space and the anterior hyoid and capsular attachment in posterior congenital cataracts very often. So you may not be able to achieve that real space in those and have to do an anterior vitrectomy, which of course is the standard of care presently, you know, for pediatrics.
Now, what about the case where you're going to put a CTR also, the bad pseudoexfoliation? Are you putting that before doing the posterior capsular rexus?
Good question. You can do it before or after. Menapachi says you could do it even if you start and it's hard to do to make it go because it's so loose. But I never was bold enough to do that personally. So if it's loose, if that bag is loose, put your CTR before, after, you know, you've done, and you don't want to ruin zonule. So there are nuances about your anterorexis as well, you know, supporting it and you know, properly treating your anterorexis so you don't destroy zonules. But the point would be to place your CTR before you put your before you put the OVD in the sulcus, right? To collapse the two membranes together. Well, as soon as you've finished your phaco and you know, you're polishing, if you want to polish, you really don't have to. But I think it's really good to polish your anterior and really be clean about this when you're doing posterior optic capture. Because when we do it and you're not doing a primary posterior capsulorexis, you know, it increases the YAG rate to really aggressively polish your anterior capsules because you don't get that sandwich effect. But when you're doing this, that doesn't matter. And the other advantage in pediatrics of posterior optic capture is now you'd be able to open your bag and put in a secondary lens, you know, in the sulcus and anterior capture for if you need a secondary lens after the eye grows, you know, if we don't have perfect lens or, you know, some other way of adjusting our outcome, you know, our refractive outcome for children.
Are you adjusting the IOL power then? Let's say you have an adult cataract with loose zonular support and you're going to do a primary posterior capsulorexis, capture the three-piece lens optic behind the posterior capsule. Are you now adding a little to the IOL power, adding a half step?
So there's no perfect nomogram. Menapachi didn't get around to it. He was going to do it, and for some reason it didn't happen. But basically, you add 50, you add half diopter to it, unless you're way high. If you're way low on your power, it doesn't really matter. Keep in mind that the posterior capsule is so flexible, you know, that it's not going to be dramatic. I think if you had, you know, an over 25 diopter lens, you might consider adding 3/4 of a diopter, but no one has done a perfect nomogram for that as yet. But guess what? Menapachi did show that the effective lens position remains stable when you posterior optic capture. Don't have to guess. That's the main variable that we don't have control over.
Effective lens position, for sure. That's the big variable in IOL calcs. Yeah. So interesting. You're just, yeah, it's a neat concept, something I really haven't thought of, hasn't gained widespread traction here in the U.S.
Not at all. Well, for one thing, you know, you don't get paid much for it. You're in a hurry. You know, there's a little chance of a little extra risk, you know, when you're learning, especially. And I did get to speak at the AAO one year at the controversies symposium, and I spoke for it and Osher spoke against it. And the only thing he spoke against was that there might be more complications, you know, until people really learn. But I just can't get anybody to, you know, you make so much money on YAG laser capsulotomies, you know, that there's just no incentive to prevent them. But, you know, particularly with us doing But people are just timid. You've spent your entire life being told, don't touch that posterior capsule, you know, and it's just not rocket science. If you can do a reliable and good anterorexis, you can do this. And I've spent quite a while trying to make it happen with Femto, and there are many glitches you probably don't have time or interest to discuss, you know, so far. And I even did a lab for Minosis when they had the Zepto before it went to centricity, and we could do it in the lab, posterorexis, but they're not interested in pursuing that either. So I can't get anybody, you know, to me, that would be if you could do a great posterior capsulotomy with the Femto, that'd be one of the main reasons to have a Femto, right?
Right. Well, you know, one of the challenges, though, is for all of us in practice, is like, oh, you say it's a 150 case learning curve. And you think, you know,
well, that's what he decided. He only had one complication in his first 150 cases, as did I. And mine was a very unusual case, but it's true. But every time you adopt anything, there's a learning curve. If you get a new phaco tip, there's a learning curve. I mean, to me, it looks like, you know, I learned with intracap in the first years of my residency, and then extracap, huge learning curve, right? And then phaco, gigantic learning curve, right? And now we're talking about just this teeny little, you know, you're just pressing. It's a little, I should mention, When you enter your capture, you just press on the optic, 90 degrees away from the optic haptic junction, and it pops in. Well, this is, doesn't really pop. You have to like be a little more gentle in walking it from optic haptic junction to optic haptic junction on both sides, you know, because it's a 4 micron, you know, thing. But the thing is, you have a complication, you break it, so you enter your capture.
Yeah, you get the enter.
Okay, so reverse capture it. You know, you're already in the bag with this thing and you're trying to you're doing a Rexis and you miss. So control everything and just enter capture if you don't trust your bag, or convert that to a tiny little Rexis, you know, or once you're putting your lens, one time I was capturing my lens and I was trying a Hoya lens that had a more 90 degree, but it was very stiff, and I broke my posterior capsular Rexis with it. So I just picked it up and I enter captured it. No harm, no foul.
And you're good to go.
Reverse captured it.
Yeah, so one of the issues, though, is that, you know, now so many, I'd say the vast majority of our IOLs are single-piece acrylic lenses. All of the, even our monofocal lenses, number one selling in the U.S. is for sure single-piece acrylic by every manufacturer. Toric IOLs, only single-piece acrylic. EDOF IOLs, only single-piece acrylic. And then trifocal.
Believe me, I'm aware, because I want to know what I should put in my eye when the time comes, okay?
So, what's the answer? Know, I don't know. What's the answer?
If we have something that fills the bag, Liliana Warner has shown us that probably it's not going to cause EAG, right? But we don't have anything that really does that yet safely by any means. Now, to me, I've been trying to talk to manufacturers about the fact that if they would put all this great technology on a three-piece lens, nobody would, you know, everybody would use their one piece, because now you'd have a backup for all your complications. You'd be able to do all of these different things, you know, put it anywhere you like. You'd only have the inventory from one manufacturer, not have to have this special lens and that special lens, you know. You wouldn't need to do AKs as a backup, you know, when you can't do your toric. You'd never end up having to you have to put it in the right place at the right time, you know, but you would never have to go back and rotate. And I think manufacturers would really be well advised, you know, to give us something. Now the problem is there is no Sulcus approved, no FDA approved Sulcus lens. Correct. And no FDA approved pediatric lens, which, by the way, they're very keen to be able to do, because it's very clear we need to put lenses into children, you know, maybe not under 6 months, but certainly over. You know, there's a lot of room here for this. Of course, Marie-Jose, when she does her bag in the lens, can't get anybody to learn this and do it. And that's an even more challenging, because her bag in the lens requires a perfectly sized and centered anterior and posterior capsule, which this does not. This is your standard capture. And it's totally zonule dependent. So although there's no fibrosis, there is a Summering's ring and there is added weight. And not infrequently, she has these bean-shaped CTRs that she puts in to shelve into the sulcus to support it. So to my way of thinking, a three-piece lens is already like that, you know. And not only that, if you opt to capture, you don't need a square edge.
Right.
So we're going to get rid of a lot of our dysphotopsia.
Right. No, all makes a lot of sense. For those who don't know, the bag in the lens concept is you got to have a perfect anterior capsular axis, posterior capsular axis. The IOL is a special IOL that at the edge of the optic has like some lips. And that's
it's basically a flange. It's a groove into which you put both the anterior and the posterior capsule 360 degrees. So now you have your lens in the middle and it's all zonule dependent. And interestingly, over years, you dilate that patient as far as you can dilate it. It's absolutely clear. Pupil edge to pupil edge. But on some postmorts that were sent to Liliana Warner at Utah, they found there is a Summering's ring in there, which is interesting because that might prevent a dead bag. I mean, if you allow cells to do their thing, I don't know, you know, but that's all supposition, of course. But so I'm glad you went back and explained that, because that's something that has a lot of advantages. There are some really good articles in the literature too about having to do vitrectomies with those in place, and they do so much better than if you know they don't subluxate, and you know it's very, very nice. They can and there's so much research to be, you know, we don't have an OCT other than intraoperative that actually images the retrolenticular space. By the way, there's a man named Dan Goldberg who has really the most advanced theory of accommodation and has also fought the pressures of the powers that be to have any real attention for it. And he's starting to get a little recognition. And there's so much to learn about the posterior zonules and their attachments to the ciliary muscle and about the anterior hilar. We talk all the time about what a posterior vitreous detachment does, but we never talk about what an anterior hilar detachment, anterior vitreous detachment does. And there's little we know about that with regard to glaucoma and so on that really will behoove us to learn in the coming years. And no one images that. All the machines can only image to the posterior capsule or maybe a hair below or the retina.
Right. Yeah, you also brought another important topic of the idea of filling the bag completely. So I have a little experience in the area. In 2015, 9 years ago, I did the first human implantations for the LensGen Juvene, the accommodating lens, which actually comes in two parts through a regular phaco incision. But yeah, you're right, fills the bag completely. And one of the surprising things was zero PCO rate, even 9 years later.
That's right. We do know that if we can keep that bag apart. Now, what we don't understand is about dead bag. What the heck is that? But anyhow, if we can keep that bag apart, you know, that somehow you take care of the fact that cells will continue to grow until they meet. You know, you ruin the attachment of cells to each other, and they're going to grow to try to attach, right? And they're going to go through metaplasia and so on because they don't have their normal healthy situation with aqueous flowing and so on. So that's the shining hope. But you know, am I going to wait 20 years for my cataract surgery? I don't think it's likely that's going to happen. You know, so
what do you choose then?
Well, I want to talk to the LAL people. I have a little astigmatism. I would have to go with a mini, you know, mini mono. I understand there's a little more give. It's almost EDOF-ish. I wish they would figure out how to put a little more technology on their LAL. And if the perfect lens comes, you know, where you can redo, you know, all these refractive index shapings, that'll be fabulous. But the LAL at least is a three-piece lens. And I don't know if anyone has experience in sulcus implanting that and optic capturing it. And I was going to talk to those folks about it. Do you know?
Well, so we've had a couple of videos for Cataract Coach. And one of the warnings is that the haptic-optic junction, like for a Yamane procedure, even optic capture through the Rexus, apparently is not super strong, and they've been known to disinsert.
And, you know, I don't know about, you know, treating them in Burger space. You know, I don't know how that would go. You know, I guess there's no research about that, you know, but it is, it looks like this instead of like, ideally, you know, here's my optic, here's my haptic, and right, it's like this kind of, right? Not like that. Right. So I didn't know, I never have read or talked to anybody who's tried to sulcus implant those, but if they would just, you know, fix that. And then, you know, there's been a big to-do about the Lucia lens for Yamane, you know, the haptics. Steve Safran first recognized this, and they can twist in there. And if the eye goes hypotenuse at all, even though that PVDF, haptic is the strongest and the best, if it doesn't stay put in the optic, you're in a lot of trouble. And they don't know why that started, and I don't think that ever got a handle on that. So that's a little bit of a crapshoot itself.
Yeah, we featured those videos on Cataract Coach, where basically the haptic-optic junction of that CT Lucia lens is very loose, and you can get it, literally the haptic can be spinning in there. So we've had some innovative surgeons who now use like the retina endo laser to really kind of melt that area a little bit more to help ensure a better fit. So
I didn't know about that. That's interesting.
I'll send you a video link. It's already been shown on Cataract Coach.
Oh, I'm sorry I missed that somehow.
With 2,000 plus videos, it's hard to see them all. But I think you're okay with a silicone material over acrylic for your eye?
Well, you know, we know silicone is more biocompatible than acrylic, whereas acrylic is more capsule compatible. Right. So if we're not worried about the capsule compatibility because we're going to opt to capture, then that's not really an issue. And it is more biocompatible. Now, I have heard that, you know, in multiple locking ins or whatever, you know, with the LAL, that these may become kind of fragile altogether. You know, I don't know if you would be more on top of that than I am, but silicone per se, I don't have a problem. And you know what? We used to have the Star AR. our 40 series, where we had elastomide haptics that were actually wide enough to actually fit most sulcuses, whereas, you know, our current 3D lenses don't fit the sulcus. Remember that?
The AQ 2010.
The AQ, yeah. 2010, I think it was. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right.
Anyway, the AQ series were silicone. They were great in the sulcus.
Right.
And it was the only lens that you could really reliably put in the sulcus and not have to optic capture. And they were quite safe. They didn't have a square edge, you know, so they didn't create UGG. And they had wide, long enough, good memory. You know, PMMA does not have decent memory at all.
Right.
So, you know, those haptics, when we put them in, they're just toast from the point of view of the memory of their shape. You know, within a couple of 3 weeks, if you look at the actually degradation charts of the memory of the shape of these PMMA haptics, they don't really stay that strong. And if you put, I would never put a three-piece lens in the sulcus without either optic capture or some sort of suture or something to hold it steady, because there's little micro movements, and they'll almost always find their way to whatever little zonule problem or capsule problem you had in sunset or sunrise, you know, later in life.
Right. That Star lens had a bigger 6.3 millimeter optic, and then the overall length of the lens, haptic to haptic, was significantly larger than
what that was the key. That was the key. And it had good memory. They were elastomide, okay, which had good memory.
But we don't have that.
Quit making it.
So that's one of those things where I guess ophthalmologists need to be a little bit more in the ear of the manufacturer, say, listen, we need this. Don't stop making this thing.
Oh, I've been yelling, but nobody listens to me because I don't buy anything anymore. it really helps when you do high volume. It really helps that, you know, you get a much better relationship with industry. But, you know, I never took any real consultants fee. I had a couple of unrestricted research grants, but I never ever in my lifetime actually had a significant consultants fee. And on the one hand, maybe that was stupid. On the other hand, you know, and bad negotiation, whatever. But on the other hand, it left me free to choose whatever I thought was best for my patient at the time and to explain to people why.
Yeah, you know, interestingly, so I did both sides of that coin. So I was a consultant for a lot of the companies with a long disclosure list. But in the last like 10 years, essentially nothing. So I will work with small startups where I do love the idea, want to work with them, develop this. Maybe I'll have some ownership stake in it. But I don't do any consulting for the big companies because I, like you, want to have that freedom to just let me talk from the heart and from the mind.
I mean, you know, when the Sovereign first came out with the very first non-continuous phaco, you know, I immediately switched to that. And I had to explain to people, you know, why and how great it was and all that. And, you know, I really pissed the competitor off, let me tell you, who I was using. And then they came up with something a little better and I switched to them. And, you know, it's like, although individuals love me, actually corporate never particularly loved me. But patients did. That's all that really mattered to me, is my outcomes and my patients.
Of course, you're loyal to your patients first and your practice and yourself, and then loyalty to any company, that's not important. I'm totally with you, 100%.
And we need them. We need them terribly, and they're wonderful. They're wonderful, but the bottom line drives them more than it drives us.
Yeah, for sure. Be loyal to your patients. Absolutely. Now, you're keeping up with, I saw you at a meeting in Tampa, Florida. And you're keeping up with all this. So even though you're not in clinical practice anymore, you're still very much interested in teaching and sharing your knowledge.
I get a lot of positive feedback from it. Every time I give a lecture, it seems I'm invited to give another. And, you know, the key thing is, my biggest fear is I need to know when I'm no longer, you know, for example, I found out from you, my videos are no longer of the quality that they really need to be. And I had some very important teaching points in those videos, you know, so I don't want to be, I don't want to outstay my welcome, so to speak. I don't want to be, you know, say, and of course my cases are old. The amazing thing is that a case that I did so long ago is still very valid for teaching and so on, if not the right quality of teaching, you know, of, 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 right. of, of video. You know, I'm intellectually stimulated, and I have a great deal of joy in this knowledge. And my husband puts up with me the fact that, you know, I don't get paid for anything and I pay to teach. And, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, sometimes I even miss a birthday party now, you know, of a grandkid, you know, because of a meeting, you know, darn it, or a performance of my opera singer daughter, or my funk soul a cappella singwriter song daughter, or my cantor daughter. I have a lot of art in my family, and no doctors, so I'm not sure who's taking care of me.
I'm sure you're great. Well, I love your passion. I love your passion for all this, your passion for teaching. Yeah, in terms of videos, the new generation, the younger ophthalmologists, say in their 30s and 40s, will not watch a video that's in the old definition of basically 640 by 40 pixels.
Yeah.
I featured those videos before on cataractcoach.com, and they get 1/10 the views.
I understand, but the points are still valid. So,
for sure.
Yeah. So what I have to do is I have to teach somebody with a great video system how to do
right.
it. And actually, Burkhard Dick offered to do that, but I think he's been so busy that he hasn't. When that actually happened, Burkhard said to me, "Why don't you just tell me what to video and I'll video it? I won't even say it's me. We can say it's you." And I said, no way that's going to happen, you know, but I would love that if, you know, somebody would do it my way and let me explain why it's valid. The other passion that I have is for brunescent cataracts. I had every cornea look the same as the 20/50 cataract the next morning, though it was a 20-minute case, to do my circumferential disassembly with cross-action vertical chop, which is something I described in 2006 but couldn't get anybody to learn. It involves using burst mode, and it's another passion of mine that people do not have to lose endothelial cells because they have a brunescent lens, and I really never had to convert. And of course, you want to learn M6 because that's how you want to convert rather than extra cap these days in case you need to, or even make a partial incision without entry before a brunescent lens. But if you learn my technique, you will not need to convert. Even, and believe me, in Iowa, they came off the farm with true brunescence that Indians would recognize as that. That was another passion of mine. The Sethis in Delhi came up to me one day after a lecture in 1994 and said, "Would you come help us create an indigent eye hospital?" And my husband and I have been 5 times there, and we worked with them not only on surgery, but we brought our lead tech and our lead wow. Scrub nurse, who, you know, didn't even have a passport and never left Iowa, you know, and took them right to Delhi, and then they later got wonderful money from Mormons and have built an amazing unit. I've tried to get them the Chang Crandall Award, but it hasn't happened over these years because they've really done thousands of free surgeries and seen millions of people in free glasses and everything. It's another passion. I was never able to operate with a knife and a fork. I was always a control freak, so I only taught the surgery. I didn't go to camps and do large volumes. I just can't do that.
So if we want to still learn from you, obviously, we'll see you on the podium, but are you still doing the hands-on in the wet labs at the ASCRS and the Academy? Because that's my fondest memory.
Well, I started actually the anterior vitrectomy wet lab in 2006 at ASCRS and also at AAO, but the retina committee at AAO made me give it up within a year because I was teaching pars plana, one-port pars plana. And they didn't think that was appropriate at the time. And I continued with the wet lab at ASCRS until 2 years ago when somebody came up to me and said, you know, could we have some new blood? You've been doing this so long. So I have just bowed out of that. So no, I no longer do the wet labs. And, you know, even, I mean, I don't feel that I should be an instructor in a wet lab, although I did lots of iris and, you know, lots of anterior segment reconstruction. I just haven't had my hands in it for so long that I've accepted myself from that area. But I do once in a while, when someone wants, come and observe and make notes and compare videos and talk about potential things that could be improved and that sort
Fantastic.
Of thing.
Fantastic. Well, we'll continue to learn from you on the podium and obviously from the large library of amazing teaching materials you have out there. I just want to thank you. What an incredible podcast. You've done so much for our field. You have directly influenced thousands of ophthalmologists who've then treated basically millions of patients. So truly outstanding.
Thank you so much. And I have the utmost respect for you and what you've done. And it's an absolute privilege to be part of this podcast today. Thank you for asking me.
Oh, my pleasure. And I want to remind our viewers and listeners, remember, we've got a new podcast every single week. It's on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast, you find the cataractcoach.com podcast. Also, remember, check out our website. We got that free PDF book, How to Learn Cataract Surgery, the free 25-part curriculum series, and, of course, our free daily email. And we're still doing a new video every single day. We will catch you next time.